run to and fro through the streets of Jerusalem, and see now and know and seek in the broad places thereof. Of course, in the old King James language, maybe that was fairly clear. What he's talking about here is more of the marketplaces or the open places of trade, where he talks about the broad places. So look all over town, in other words. Look in the markets, look in the narrow streets, in the outskirts, look all the way through town, everywhere you can look. If you can find a man, if there be any, that executes judgment, that seeks the truth, and I'll pardon it. Of course, that harks back to the what God said about Sodom and Gomorrah and how many he'd spare it for there and the time of the flood. And God's principle always has been that if there are enough righteous in a place, then he'll spare it. If there aren't, then he'll take them out of it and destroy it. That's what he's always done, whether it be Sodom and Gomorrah, or the flood, or any other time. But God doesn't destroy the righteous with the wicked. And interestingly enough, back in the Inquisition, they asked Pope Innocent III about a crusade in against the Waldensians and the Albigensians, and he said, well, how will we know who they are? And he just said, well, slay them all. God will know his own. So that isn't exactly what it says in the Scriptures, you notice. God says if you can find a man that follows these conditions, executes judgment, and of course the only way you can do that is know what God's judgments are. They're justice, they're equitable and fair. Someone that seeks the truth, and then God will pardon the whole place just for the one individual. Though they say the eternal lives, surely they swear falsely. So here again, he typifies the people of Jerusalem as religious. They swear by God, but they swear falsely. O eternal, are not your eyes upon the truth? You've stricken them, but they haven't grieved. They didn't feel the pain. They didn't notice that, you notice, a nation can be stricken, and they won't admit that it's because of immorality or because of going away from God. And, you know, you can see how the nation's stricken with volcanic eruptions and weird weather, droughts and crazy rains and extremes, unbalanced weather. So God can strike them, but it doesn't even pain them. They don't even recognize it. They just say, oh, well, we're just in another cycle. Or, you know, you always have your ups and downs, or these things always come and go, or we've always gotten out of all of our troubles before. So that's an attitude that God says would be there. You've consumed them, but they've refused to receive correction. So they can die by the millions or thousands in wars and violence and all kinds of corruption, but they don't associate that with God or with the way they live or anything else. They've made their faces harder than a rock. So usually if someone suffers and they don't associate it with wrong, then they just get harder and tougher and more grizzled. Therefore, I said, surely these are poor, they're foolish, they know not the way of the eternal, nor the judgment of their God. So they'll never attribute any difficulties to any judgment from God. They don't even know the way of God. And you're going to see in the next few chapters how vividly he describes the Christianity that took the name Christ and put it on all their paganism and call it Christian. But they don't know the way of the eternal. They're foolish and they're poor, reduced in their means or impoverished. I'll get me unto the great men. So, since the average man doesn't see and recognize, then check with the rich, with the powerful, check with the politician, the leaders, and the millionaires, and see if they recognize anything. I'll get me to the great men and speak to them. They've known the way of the eternal, the judgment of their God. the thieves have altogether broken the yoke and burst the bonds. So they likewise have forgotten all about God, and together with one accord, all have broken the yoke and burst the bonds. So then God pictures what's going to come on them. Here again, he pictures world empires by animals and birds. Wherefore, a lion out of the forest shall slay them. A wolf of the evenings, or deserts, the darkness, shall spoil them. The leopard shall watch over their cities. Of course, the lion was Babylon, the leopard was Alexander the Great's time. Wolf was just a devouring night creature described here. Everyone that goes out thence shall be torn in pieces, because they're, and here they again mistranslate a word that isn't transgressions. It's a much worse word in the Hebrew. Pesha means revolt, rebellion, stubborn, calloused, lawless, rebellious, revolting attitude. Not just transgressing, stepping beyond the law. Because their revolts are many, their backslidings, apostasies, be the Greek word, are increased. Very severe in number and in wretchedness. How shall I pardon you for this? Your children have forsaken me and sworn by them that are no gods. So here he goes back again to the contrast of what people worship, all kinds of idols and ways of men and the ways of the heathen. When I had fed them to the full, when we hit the peak of our prosperity and inheriting Israel and developing it and building it up to its potential, when God had fed us to the full, then when people were, they lost their natural drive and national aim, then what happens? Well, then you turn to morality or immorality. You turn to materialism, the flesh. They then committed adultery and assembled themselves by troops in the harlots' houses. And that's a pretty good description of what has happened in the last few years when you see all of the pornography places that have popped up and all of the film places and all of the immorality. There is fed horses in the morning. In other words, right after you're really refreshed and feeling vigorous and zippy and active. So like fed horses in the morning, everyone neighed after his neighbor's wife. So God prophesied that people would lose that loyalty to their own mate and devotion to their own mate and dedication to their own mate. Instead of that, everybody goes by sight and everybody thinks they're entitled to somebody else. And so of all the descriptions in the Bible of sexual immorality, that's the most vivid one of all. Assemble themselves by troops in the harlots' houses. Fed horses in the morning, everyone neighing after his neighbor's wife. Now God says, shall I not visit for these things? You know, they don't do that in China. They don't do that in Russia. They don't do that in a lot of the major nations in the world. But they certainly do that in Norway and Sweden and in England and America. You know, they do that in Israel. And then God says, shall I not visit for these things? So even though you swear by God's name, look at the way you live. You say you're Christians. You say you're the Christian nations. You say that God is with you, and you pray and ask God to deliver your captives and everything else, but then look at the way you live. Shall I not visit for these things, says the Eternal, and shall not my soul be avenged? So here God again talks about his soul. I myself, or my soul, shall I not myself and my own soul be avenged on such a nation as this? Well, go you up on our walls and destroy, but make not a full end. So as we've seen, there will be a tithe left in Israel after they're chastened totally. Make not a full end, just like don't glean the pasture garden totally. Take away her battlements, for they're not the Eternal. So instead of depending on God for our protection, we're depending on ourselves and our allies and all of our lovers and everything else. So God says, go take a look at America's walls of defense. Take a good look at their battlements? What do they trust in? What's their security? What's their defense? Well, either our own weaponry, our own lovers, but they're not the Eternals. For the house of Israel and the house of Judah. So here again, at the time of the end time calamity, the time of the description of this sexual immorality and all the things going on, they're still two separate houses. They didn't come back as one in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. They didn't combine into one over in Assyria or Babylon. There's still two houses. The house of Israel and the house of Judah have dealt very treacherously against me, says the Eternal. They have belied the Eternal. In other words, they've been deceitful. They swear by his name. They claim they're Christian. And yet, look at the way they live. They said, is not he, neither shall evil come upon us, neither shall we see sword nor famine. So there's always been the false prophets that contradict the true prophets, and they say, no, that's not going to happen to us. We had the students today going through an ex-minister's material on the tithing, and he was saying, why, that's ridiculous to say America's under a curse. Why, we're the most blessed, prosperous nation in the world. Why, people want to come here from everywhere. Who can say we're under a curse and we're going down, we're going to be taken captive and defeated? And he said, peace and safety. No evil's going to come on us. We're not going to see sword nor famine. And he'll probably still be saying that when they drag him off. As they were back in the days of Noah, you know. A flood? You ridiculous. Don't be crazy. We never have much rain at all, much less a flood out here in this desert. And they probably said that as the water got knee-deep and waist-deep and neck-deep. Then they swam as long as they could. And that's the way man is, you know. But notice how he says, they say, no, no evil's going to come on us. Don't listen to those sundowners. You know where we're listed in the handbook of denominations? Under pessimistic sects. That's right. That's where you have to find us. Now, we're lumped there with Jehovah's Witnesses and Adventists. And I don't find God's people pessimistic, not in their personal present life. About the future, you might say that. Neither shall evil come on us. We're not going to see sword or famine. Why, these prophets are just windbags. God's word isn't in them. It isn't going to be done to us that way. Wherefore, thus says the Eternal God of hosts. And here's a title that occurs in Jeremiah four times. Again, just a coincidence, God's number. You find it again in chapter 15 and verse 16, chapter 35 and verse 17, chapter 49 and verse 5. The Eternal God of hosts, because you speak this word, behold, I'll make my words in your mouth fire, and this people wood, and it'll devour them. So here God likens the sayings of the prophet as being like fire that's going to devour the people that are wood. Lo, I'll bring a nation upon you from far, O house of Israel, says the Eternal. A mighty nation, an ancient nation. So it goes all the way back to Genesis 10, Babel or Babylon. The same Babylonian power, the old Roman resurrected empire, still a part of old Nebuchadnezzar's system. So it's not a new nation, but it's an ancient nation. It's a mighty nation, and it isn't nearby, it's afar. A nation whose language you don't know. So they can't be a people that speak English, but they're a nation with their own language. Neither understands you what they say. So not only you don't speak their language, you're not like them in your talk even. You don't think the way they think. You know, that's kind of sad to see a man like Mr. Carter who just couldn't understand the way the Russians think. He believed them, you know. He listened to them, and he couldn't think the way they think. He didn't know what the nature of a bear is. So God describes that several ways there. Their quiver is an open sepulcher. They're almighty men. They'll eat up your harvest, your bread, your sons, your daughters should eat. They'll eat up your flocks and your herds. They'll eat up your vines and your fig trees. They'll beat down, impoverish your fenced cities. You know, when it talks about eating up your harvest and bread that your sons and daughters should eat, you might notice Habakkuk 3 and verse 17, tying all the prophecies again, they all speak the same thing. Habakkuk chapter 3. Here he talks about, although the fig tree shall not blossom, neither shall fruit be in the vines, the labor of the olive shall fail, the field shall yield no meat, the flocks shall be cut off from the fold, and there will be no herd in the stalls. Nevertheless, back in Jeremiah 5 again, nevertheless in those days, so notice again the key phrase, in those days, in that day, says the Eternal, I'll not make a full end with you. So there's always that good news that even though Israel's going to have to be thinned down in numbers, they're still going to be delivered, a remnant of them. It'll come to pass when you'll say, wherefore does the Eternal our God all these things to us? So, you know, they're not going to understand that. We're the Christian world. Why does the God of the Bible punish the Christian nations first? Looks like he'd smite the Oriental heathen. Looks like he'd smite somebody else first. But, you know, smite those Arab Muslims. But no, no, he smites Christians first. So they're going to say, well, why did you do that to us? Why us? Well, look at the way you live. Shall I not punish you for all these things? Look at the way you're doing. I've got to punish you because you've claimed you're Christian, and look at the way you live. And then when I've punished you for your wickedness, then I'll deal with those others. Then shall you answer them, like as you've forsaken me and served alien foreign gods, strange gods, in your land. And that's what we've done, you know. We've gone the way of Baal and Baalism and all kinds of paganism. So shall you serve strangers in a land that's not yours. So you've brought strange gods into my land. I'm going to send you into the lands of those strange gods. You want to serve them? Let me just turn you over to them and send you into their land. Declare this in the house of Jacob and publish it in Judah. Hear now this, O foolish people, and without understanding or heart, you have eyes that you don't see and you have ears that don't hear. So here again shows the blindness on Israel. There are people that should know God. They're descendants of the very people of the Bible, but their eyes don't see and their ears don't hear. And then notice another thing. They don't fear God. Fear you not me, says the Eternal? Will you not tremble at my presence? You know, the world's religions don't believe in fear. They say, well, boy, they don't want anything to do with any fear religion. And yet, the fear of God's the beginning of knowledge. You know, you have to fear God to live by the Bible. There has to be that reverence and awe and that respect and trembling before God. You've placed, here he's talking about his miracles again, the Eternal, which has placed the sand for the bound of the sea by a perpetual decree that it can't pass it. Now, every time I go out and stand on the ocean and watch the ocean, I can't believe that. You know, that water never goes anywhere else. It just comes up there in high tide and low tide, and it can't go any further. And, you know, waves don't go anywhere. They just rising up and down, yet you look like they're coming in when you watch the ocean. Well, I know you can explain it scientifically, but I can't understand it. But I know God placed the sand for the bound of the sea by a perpetual decree it can't pass. Though the waves thereof toss themselves, and you can have all kinds of horrible storms on the sea, and yet when they get to the beach, it's not there. They still come in on high tide and low tide. Yet they cannot prevail, though they roar, yet they cannot pass over. You know, you want to get a nice-smelling green pine tree in your house 9 months out of the year? Have at it. That's great, you know. But don't do it in December and try to tie Christ's birth in with it. There's nothing wrong with the family getting together, with children and fathers and mothers doing things together. But you can't worship God by pagan practices. Children gather the wood. Fathers kindle the fire. Women knead the dough. They make hot cross buns. They make all this pagan to the Queen of Heaven. And you know, it's kind of interesting how the counterfeit is. You might notice back in Daniel, God's the king of heaven. Sure enough, there isn't a queen of heaven. There's a king of heaven. Daniel 4:37. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the king of heaven, all whose works are truth, his ways judgment, those that walk in pride he's able to obey. But there's no queen of heaven. Easter, Ashtaroth, Astarte, all the same name. But that's their Easter rigor. Pour out drink offerings to other gods, provoke God to anger. Is that what they think they're doing? They're not provoking God to anger. Do they provoke me? They? Dirt? Human? Temporary mortals? They provoke me? The reason I feel sorry for them is the stupidity. I can't bless them and I can't let them do what I created them for. Do not they provoke themselves to the confusion of their own faces? Do they provoke me? Well, I should say not. I'm God. Mortal humans, dummies, it's themselves that they're hurting. They're not provoking me to anger. I'm the great God that made them out of the dust of the ground and breathed the breath of life into them. They provoke themselves to the confusion of their own faces. Go around thinking they're Christian, waiting for God's blessings, and they're heathen. Therefore, thus says the Lord Eternal, behold, mine anger and my fury shall be poured out upon this place. So the very spot that's supposedly holy, the temple of God, his fury, his anger is going to be poured out on the Holy Land in Megiddo, all over, blood up to the horses' bridles, right? Down from Mount Zion, on man and beast. Here the word man is Adam. And upon the trees of the field, on the fruit of the ground. Now, you know, when you read that, you recognize that some of the trumpet plagues in the book of Revelation are part of the supernatural wrath of God, because look where it's poured out on. It's poured out on beast, man, trees, fruit of the ground. It'll burn and not be quenched, which means when God decides to burn something, it burns it up. No man can put it out. That's what unquenchable means in the Bible. Another good word, verse for hell there, verse 20. Thus says the Eternal of Hosts, the God of Israel, add all your burnt offerings to your sacrifices and eat all those rituals. It doesn't do you any good. It isn't going to amount to anything. I didn't speak to your fathers, nor command them in the day I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings or sacrifices. That wasn't a part of that covenant. That was added later because they didn't keep the covenant. They transgressed, so I had to add that later. That's one of the key verses in the Bible there, verse 22. The only church in the world that understands that is the one you're in. Adventists don't understand it. Church of God Seventh Day doesn't understand it. None of them understand that. The holy days aren't rituals. Tithing's not a ceremonial law. It's not just Levitical law either. It preceded the Levitical people, and then it went after the Levitical people. Why, God said, I didn't speak a thing about all this sacrifice and ritual and ceremonial law. That was added later. I didn't speak to your fathers a thing about any of that. Now, you know, you come back and notice in Exodus 20. And we've touched on this in the previous class last summer on the doctrines of the covenants. But in Exodus 20, God spake the Ten Commandments. Well, by the time God got his introductory outline done, the people were so shaky in the knees, they said, well, Moses, we can't take this any longer. We'll all be dead men. Why don't you ask God what he's got to say to us, and then you tell us, and we'll do it. But we just, the people knew God wasn't through. Yet everybody tells you God gave the Ten Commandments, and the Adventists say God wrote them with his own finger, and that's all there is to the Old Covenant, the tablets of the Ten Commandments, and that's all not so. The covenant was a book of law. It wasn't tablets only. And what was in the Ark of the Covenant wasn't just Ten Commandment tablets. That's just the introductory outline. You notice God didn't suggest he was through speaking here at all. The people were the ones that knew God wasn't through. They knew he was going to speak more. But they've just acted humanly out of weakness and fear and said, we just can't listen to God anymore. Moses, you tell us the rest of it. And that's what God said, all right. Verse 22, God said, all right, I'll tell you, and then you tell them. And the most common repeated phrase in the law is, the Eternal said unto Moses, speaking to the children of Israel, and saying to them, over and over, you'll wear out a pencil marking that one little sentence. Notice what he goes on to say. Chapter 21, now these are the judgments you set before them. And that's what he gives. Laws between a man and his neighbor. Chapter 21, chapter 22, chapter 23. Now notice chapter 24. Now he says to Moses, I've given you the judgments that you're to give to them. Go down and give them to them. Then when you come back up, bring somebody else up with you, because I've got something to give to them. So bring back up Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and you know who they are. Bring back up the 70 elders. So what else he's going to give has to relate to the nation. The 70 elders are there. Has to relate to the priesthood. Aaron and Nadab and Abihu are there. So Moses goes down and gives them the statutes and judgments. Notice verse 3. He told the people all the words, all the judgments. All the people said all the words the Eternal has said. Even though Moses told them, they admitted it was God that had said them. So Moses wrote all those things in the book. And when they sealed the covenant, look at verse 7. He took the book of the covenant, read it all. They all said, all the Eternal said, we'll do. Moses took the blood and sprinkled the blood of the covenant, sealed the covenant. Then he takes Nadab and Abihu with Aaron and back up. Then he starts telling them all about the tabernacle and the ark, all about the tabernacle curtains, all about the altar of burnt offering, all about how to consecrate priests and the altar of incense, and about getting master workmen to build all these things. And, you know, go through and see. They don't get to working on this physical thing and break a Sabbath law. They start work on it, chapter 36, 37 and 38. They get the priest garments ready in 39. They set the tabernacle up in 40. Now notice, the next book is entitled Leviticus, relating to the priests. So now God calls to Moses and speaks out of the tabernacle of the congregation. Not from Mount Sinai. Not up there where they got the moral law. Now he speaks out of that tabernacle they've just set up. And so they come in there and they consecrate the priests. And finally, the first sacrifices accomplished at all are on over here in chapter 9. On the eighth day, Moses called Aaron and his sons, and then the ritual starts. But back up to Exodus 40 and notice what it says. Verse 17. It came to pass in the first month, in the second year, on the first day of the month, the tabernacle was reared up. Then he speaks out of that tabernacle that's reared up, and everything that's spoken out of that tabernacle was temporary, as long as there are Levites. But that law of morals, of judgments, was given long before. So sure enough, when God says in Jeremiah, the day he made that covenant with them, he didn't say anything about ritual. That's added later. And there's no other church on earth that understands that. I know when the Church of God Seventh Day would come over to visit the Worldwide or the Radio Church of God then in Portland, I always had an extra sermon about the differences in the laws. And every time a bunch of them would come, I'd put aside the other sermon I'd gotten for that day and give that same one over and over every time they'd come. Well, half their people quit over at the other place and started coming over on Burnside where we met. Well, you know, Duggar got kind of panicky about that, came back from Jerusalem and held an evangelistic campaign up there to get all those people back. But their eyes had been opened. God said there were some in Sardis that would walk with him in white, and they just came right on out of that blindness and came over to the true church. And they understood the difference in the laws. Nobody else on earth does. That verse 22 is one of the major verses in all the Bible. When God brought the Israelites out with that covenant, he didn't say a word about sacrifice as a law. Sure, the head of the family had offered sacrifices individually back before, but not a codified law of God regulating sacrifices. Why, he said, I didn't speak to your fathers. I didn't command them in the day I brought them out of the land of Egypt about ritual and ceremony. This is the thing I commanded them. You can read right back where we read. Obey my voice, I'll be your God. You'll be my people. Walk you in all the ways, not just the tablets. Walk you in all the ways that I've commanded you, that it may be well to you. But they didn't hearken. They didn't incline their ear. They walked in the counsels, in the... Now, it isn't the imagination of their evil heart. It's the rebellion, the stubbornness of their evil heart. And they went backward, not forward. Since the day your fathers came forth out of the land of Egypt to this day, I've even sent to you all my servants, the prophets, daily, rising up early and sending them. And yet they didn't hearken to me. They didn't incline their ear. They hardened their neck. They did worse than their fathers. So you know from the day they got out of Egypt, they were always wanting to go back and wanting to rebel and wanting to listen to rebels. Therefore, you'll speak all these words to them, but they'll not hearken to you. You'll also call to them, but they're not going to answer you. You know, that's something for God to tell you. You've got to do it, even though they're not going to listen. And he tells you ahead of time before you do it, they're not going to listen. But you shall say unto them, this is a nation, the nation, the definite article there, not a, this is the nation that obeys not, that doesn't hearken to the voice of the eternal air God, the nation that doesn't receive correction. Truth has perished. It's all paganism. Can you think of a truth that they have? Well, they've got the truth that Jesus is the Christ and that he died for your sins. They don't know what sin is. They don't have anything right outside of that, you know. The only thing they've got right is the fact that Christ died for sinners. But none of them are sinners. They don't know what sin is. It's cut off from their mouth. Truth's cut off from their mouth. Cut off your hair, O Jerusalem. It's one of the tokens of sackcloth and ashes and a symbol of mourning. Cut off your hair. Cast it away. Take up a lamentation on high places. For the Eternal has rejected and forsaken the generation of his wrath. Now, you keep that in mind in the future when the president gets a big religious revival going and everybody gets back to God and starts getting back religious and back in the churches. And God still says the generation that he has, the generation of his wrath that he has rejected and forsaken. For the children of Judah have done evil in my sight, says the Eternal. They've set their abominations in the house that's called by my name. Can you imagine that? Well, over at Rome, they do that all the time, you know. They took that black statue, they filtered out of the Tiber River there and put it in the house of the gods and made him a god, you know. They say he's Peter. Well, he might have been a Peter, but he's not St. Peter. They take the old Parthenon, the old pagan temples and the Pantheon and all the old heathen buildings around Rome and give them Christian names. And then what do? They design all the other buildings after that old Pantheon. Circular dome, you know. They've set their abominations in the house that's called by God's name. That includes Christmas trees and even the Adventists, you know, for the children have their Christmas trees. Exchange gifts. Of course, the Jews call it Hanukkah, but it's Christmas. They couldn't associate it. They wouldn't dare have it named Christmas, you know. They pollute God's house, the name Christian Church. They've built the high places of Tophet, which is in the valley of the sons of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters. So God says, you think that was ancient history when they passed their children through the fire and burnt their sons and daughters to these gods in that one section of Tophet in the valley of the sons of Hinnom? By having your sons practice paganism in Christian churches, you're dooming them to the fire too. Which I commanded them not. Now notice this. It never arose into my heart. God never in his heart would ever think about having someone have their sons pass through the fire in the name of religion. God would not have a human sacrifice in the name of religion. God doesn't have you cause your sons to pass through the fire. God doesn't have any valley of hell and any secret cave areas of some valley of hell that you practice a weird religion. It never entered into God's heart to have anything ridiculous like that. Therefore, behold, the day has come, says the Eternal. It's no more going to be called Tophet, nor the valley of the son of Hinnom. It'll be called the valley of slaughter. So we have Tophets and Hinnoms in our Christian nations. But they're no longer called Tophet or Hinnom. They're just places people practice their paganism in Christian churches. And it's going to bring on God's slaughter. They're going to bury in Tophet till there be no place. Can you imagine the kind of trouble we're going to get in when we tell the Protestant churches all that? No wonder it says you're going to be hated of all nations. That's not that far away either. And the carcasses of this people will be food for the fowls of heaven. All kinds of countries surrounding Israel are going to devour parts of it. The beasts of the earth, the fowls of the heavens, the human governments, human countries. None are going to be able to flay them away. Then I'll cause decease from the cities of Judah and the streets of Jerusalem, the voice of mirth, the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom, the voice of the bride, because the land will be desolate. Well, that's sad that that's going to happen that time, in that way. That has to happen. Well, at that time, says the Eternal, they're going to bring out the bones of the kings of Judah. Now, of course, back at that time, they always buried all the prosperity of the leaders with them, so they find where their tombs are and dig them all up and get whatever riches are buried with all the leaders and leave your bones lying there on the ground, you know. There's nothing holy or sacred. So even the bones of the kings of Judah and the bones of these princes and the bones of the priests and the bones of the prophets and the bones of the inhabitants of Jerusalem. So you notice who he holds accountable for it? First the kings, next the princes, then the priests, then the prophets. You know, if priests did their jobs, you wouldn't need prophets. If priests could get people to practice the truth, then there wasn't a need for prophets. And as long as priests had people practicing the truth, you didn't have prophets. Well, they're going to leave those bones out of their graves. They're going to spread them. They're going to be left out, spread out, as they've dug them out of these tombs, spread out before the sun and the moon and all their gods. So they're all their gods they worship, not able to do a thing about their graves being ravaged and their bones being left unburied right out under the sun and the moon and the host of heaven. Those were their gods they worshipped. So let them lie out there barren in front of their gods and see if they can help them, whom they loved, whom they've served, after whom they've walked, and whom they sought, and whom they've worshipped. You know, if you mark sun across every verse that dealt with the Baalism of Christianity and the heathen practice of sun worship of Israel, you know, I've got sun written all the way through my Bible. Because it's just saturated with it. Now, these bones are not even going to be gathered or buried. They're going to be left out there as fertilizer on the face of the earth. Death is going to be chosen rather than life by any residue of Israel that's left from that evil family that remain in all the places where God has driven them. Those people, where they're driven, they'd rather die than to endure the punishment of heathen powers that are going to be torturing them, says the Eternal of Hosts. Moreover, you'll say to them, thus says the Eternal, shall they fall and not arise? Shall he turn away and not return? No, he already told us he won't make a full end. He's going to save a tithe, as we've already been aware of. God's system's always been the tithe, and it's going to always be that way. Why then is this people of Jerusalem slidden back by a perpetual backsliding? They hold fast deceit, they refuse to return. So they're hard-headed and set in their ways and blinded by a false Christianity telling them they're safe and secure and they're all right. Even when they're hurt, they won't admit the cause of their hurt. I hearken and heard, but they didn't speak right. No man repented him. Now, this is an example of how the Bible uses some descriptions like all Israel shall be saved. That doesn't mean every single one. And when it says no man, that doesn't mean a single one wouldn't. It means such a big majority of them wouldn't in a comparison, it's as if no man repented. There are going to be Laodiceans, quite a few of them. They're going to repent. There's going to be a tithe. We already read that. So it shows you how you better understand the terminology of the Bible. Let it interpret itself. When it says no man, that means practically none. Such a high percentage, 90%. No man in this case is 90%. Now when it says all Israel shall be saved, one of our ex-ministers has a doctrine out on that that is universal salvation, you know. Nobody's ever really been lost. In the end, everybody's going to be saved. Why, it says, it isn't God's will that any should perish, but that all should be saved. And if God's God, then they all have to be, so even the devil himself's going to get saved. Well, God sure wasted a lot of time in the lake of fire. It's going to be a surprise to him. There isn't going to be anything to put in it. Well, some people get carried away with their intellectual vanity and... Okay, verse 6 again. No man repented him of his wickedness, saying, what have I done? Everyone turned to his course as the horse rushes into the battle. Yea, the stork in the heaven, those are appointed times. The turtle dove and the crane and the swallow observe the time of their coming. So here God is telling you that he has created the migration patterns of the birds. It's built into them. God put it there. It can't be changed. Now, some birds get mixed up. You know, you see seagulls over in Tulsa, Oklahoma. What in the world are they doing there? There aren't any seas around there. But, you know, man built this shipping canal off the Mississippi. Goes all the way up to Tulsa, Oklahoma. So here these dumb seagulls think they're still around the sea, you know, up there in the farmlands. All mixed up, you know. Their instinct is nutty. But God normally gave instinct patterns into the animals, and sure enough, the turtle dove and the... real beautiful old set of books, Cassell's Bible, that illustrates a lot of the natural descriptions of things in the Scriptures, and you can see the picture of it there, how beautiful those old steel plate prints are. And here he talks about the stork resembles the crane, but is a larger bird. It feeds on insects and frogs. Its bill is so formed as to hold fast its slippery prey. It's remarkable for its tenderness and affection, especially in the case of the young toward the old. It migrates in autumn and returns in the spring. The turtle dove is also a bird of passage found in all the warm climates. It's delicate, elegant in form, is associated in our minds with all that's pure, tender, and attractive. Following the sun in his progress towards the tropics, it visits higher latitudes, spends the winter under milder skies, and returns to usher in the spring. The crane is spread over all the regions of the old continent, but passes the winter in warmer climates and is remarkable for the wisdom and foresight which it displays in its migrations. The swallow that remains with us till October is supposed to winter in Africa. Now, just as the instinct of these birds teaches them thus to migrate in winter and return in spring, so should the higher principles of religion have taught this rebellious people to return to God. But they failed to do so, and hence their conduct was contrary alike to nature and religion. But you know, if you have a hard time with your Bible study being really alive and interesting, you probably just need to get you some Bible helps and quit expecting the King James to do it all for you. Because it certainly doesn't do it all for you. You know, it just drags you back to 1611 language and soaks you in it. Okay, going back anyway. Here he says, look at the way I made all these birds to come back to where I start them out, where they nest and where they live. But my people don't know the judgment of the eternal. They don't recognize when calamities are striking them. It's their sin that's doing it. They don't repent when they have crazy... They don't repent when they have crazy weather, extremes in the weather, when their finances collapse and their marriages break up and their children desert home. And no, nobody takes that as the judgment of the eternal. My people don't know the judgment of the eternal. How do you say we are wise? And the law of the eternal is with us. Lo, certainly in vain made he. The pen of the scribes is in vain. The wise men are ashamed. They're dismayed and taken. Lo, they've rejected the word of the eternal. Boy, is that ever true. All the wise men, they reject the word of the eternal. You know what they say about Herbert Armstrong? He says he oversimplifies everything. It can't be that simple. Just stick your nose in that Bible and practice those laws and that'll solve all those words. Why, that's simple. That's overdoing. You know, that's just oversimplifying all the solutions to all a man's problems. No, it isn't. It's just putting it right on what it is. So God says the wise are ashamed. They don't have any answers. They're dismayed. They don't know what to say. They're taken in their own craftiness. Oh, yeah, but people say, oh, we're wise. Oh, you know, the law of the eternal is with us. We're Christian. What wisdom is in them? They've rejected the word of the eternal. Therefore, I'll give their wives to others. Sad that that has to happen that way, but their fields to those that inherit them, they're going to take them over and own them. Everyone from the least even to the greatest is given to covetousness. That's twice he said that. Anytime God repeats himself, it must be mighty important. Would you say this nations of Israel are just given to materialism? The main drive in their life is get. You know, more and more things, more and more physical. Can they just sit around in a simple life and enjoy creation and family and the Bible and other people? No. From the prophet, even to the priest, everyone deals falsely. Priests don't know the truth. Prophets lie about what's going to happen. They have healed the hurt of the daughter of my people slightly, saying, peace, peace, when there's no peace. 3 times we've heard that already. Any wound that might make the daughter of God's people wake up, that's what is so bad about these false prophets. There might be people that would wake up and listen and hearken, but no, they heal the hurt. Slightly saying, peace, peace, when there's no peace. Were they ashamed when they'd committed abomination? No, they weren't at all ashamed. They couldn't blush. Now, part of this is exactly what we've read earlier. Therefore, they're going to fall among them that fall. In the time of their visitation, they're going to be cast down, says the Eternal. I'll surely consume them, says the Eternal. There'll be no grapes on the vine, nor figs on the fig tree. The leaf's going to fade, and the things that I've given them shall pass away from them. Now the prophet Jeremiah begins to speak after God's told him to tell him all this, and he says, why do we sit still? If God has said all these things, let's get with it. Let's take action. Let's change. Let's do something. Assemble yourselves. Let's enter into the defense cities. Let's be silent there. The eternal our God has put us to silence, given us water of gall to drink because we've sinned against the eternal. We look for peace, but no good came. We look for a time of health and terror and trouble. Why, this invasion was so imminent, you could hear the snorting of the horses from Dan. There again shows they came in from the north. That's the northernmost tribe. So where did these snorting horses first get heard? Dan. Then the whole land trembled at the sound of the neighing of his strong ones. Again, the invaders likened to horses. They're come and they've devoured the land, all that's in it, the city and those that dwell therein. For behold, I'll send serpents, adders among you, which will not be charmed. They'll bite you, says the Eternal. When I would comfort myself against sorrow, my heart is faint in me, Jeremiah says. Behold, the voice of the cry of the daughter of my people, because of them that dwell in a far country. Is not the Eternal in Zion? Is not her king in her? No, he isn't. He's forsaken them. He withdrew from them. He left them alone. And now the daughter of his people is going to be invaded and taken. Why have they provoked me to anger with their graven images? They provoked God to withdraw from them instead of repenting. They make God remove his protection from them with their graven images and strange vanities. The harvest is past, the summer's ended, we're not saved. For the hurt of the daughter of my people, I'm hurt. Grieved to the point of just being without any life in you, black as it were, in the sense of the darkness that comes on a man when he's down, depressed and downcast. Astonishment's taken hold on me. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then is not the help of the daughter of my people recovered? Now, you know, some of these scriptures show that there's a place for a physician. There's a place for a balm in Gilead. There are certain things God has created that are natural that He means for people to know about and to help other people with. There should be a balm in Gilead. There should be a physician. Of course, spiritually, it should be God and His way of life. But physically, there are physical things man can do as well. You know, it's interesting, the word physician comes from the word physics. It's a word like physics that means natural. It's not chemist. He didn't say, is there no chemist there? He said, is there no physician? Why then is not the health of the daughter of my people recovered? And then the prophet goes on sad, and maybe even God may be speaking here too. Oh, that my head were waters, and mine eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people. So God is very sad and hates to have to think about that. You might notice these triplets always through Hebrew. Again and again and again, God summarizes a total picture with a three-word summary. And some people didn't know that. You know, a man one time said, why, you only have to tithe of corn, wine, and oil. Why, look, all those scriptures, it says corn, wine, and oil. And he was so smart, he didn't even know that God has this threefold summary of so many things all the way through the Bible. Corn, wine, and oil. That means you only tithe agricultural products. He said fishermen didn't tithe, and, you know, he said people, miners didn't tithe. And yet, what do you think Abraham tithed off when he took the spoil? Like there might have been some gold and silver in that, and maybe some boats, you know, that had fish in them or something. Well, you know, is that fair? Poor old farmer, he's got to tithe, but the fisherman doesn't have to. He just gets everything he keeps. Well, that doesn't make sense at all. But he got technical, you know, and it said you tithe corn, wine, and oil. Well, those are just three summaries of the different areas of agriculture. Corn is the field products, wine is the vine products, and oil is from trees. It's like any dummy should know that. Unless you get so smart, you strain in your technicality that you get lost in the woods. Can't even see the forest, lost in among the trees. That happens to a lot of people. Now, if you have a technical mind, don't let that happen to you. Well, here are three again. Waters, tears, fountain. There's a summary again. But that's, you could mention that almost in every chapter as you go through here. Oh, that I had in the wilderness a lodging place of wayfaring men. In other words, I just wish I had a hideout to get away from all this and not have to be out here telling all these people all this and seeing it happen. That I could just leave all these people and get a place and get off to myself. Go from them. They be all adulterers, an assembly of treacherous men. They bend their tongues like their bow for lies. I imagine if you had to go to Washington and sit up there and listen to these politicians for a month in the governmental buildings, that scripture would mean more to you than any others. Bend their tongues like their bow for lies. They're not valiant for the truth on the earth. They proceed from evil to evil, just from one evil to another. They don't know me, says the Eternal. Take you heed every one of his neighbor. Don't you trust even in a brother. It's sad that the world's getting that way. You know somebody you can trust in? Someone you can confide in? Someone you can open up and talk to and not worry about what will happen from it? Take you heed every one. The word neighbor there is the word translated friend other places. Take heed even of a friend. Confide, same word as trust there, in a brother. Every brother will utterly supplant, every neighbor will walk with slanders. Tongue, another one of the big enemies in the last days. No governing the tongue, no ruling the speech. They'll deceive everyone his friend and won't speak the truth. They've taught their tongue to speak lies. That sounds like advertising and commercials and all the materialism. They weary themselves to commit iniquity. In this place, the word is the sin of your nature, your sin of your flesh, your what you are. Your habitation is in the midst of deceit. Through deceit, they refuse to know me. Now, you notice that? Through deceit of pagan doctrines of immortal souls and ever-burning hells and going to heaven and the Trinity, through the deceit of paganism, Sunday and Christmas and Easter and Halloween, and through deceit, they can't come to know God. They're blinded. They're duped. They think it's all Christian. And they never will really get their nose in the Bible to come to really know the God of the Bible. And it's through all that deceit that they refuse to know God. That's what's so bad about it. Therefore, thus says the Eternal of Hosts, behold, I'll melt them and try them, because how shall I do for the daughter of my people? I can't bless them. I can't let them thrive and let the Oriental heathen and the Arab Muslims go down first. I can't do that. I've got to punish these false Christians first. How am I going to set up a Christian world for 1,000 years if all these Oriental heathens and Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus think all that paganism was Christianity? How shall I do for the daughter of my people? Well, I've just got to melt them, that's what. Send them through a fire of tribulation and melt away all that paganism and leave the pure Christianity that's there. Their tongue is an arrow shot out. It speaks deceit. That's right. The Christian peoples of God's nations, their tongue is an arrow shot out speaking deceit. One speaks peaceably to his neighbor with his mouth, but in his heart he's lying in wait. Shall I not visit them for these things, says the Eternal? Shall not my soul be avenged on such a nation as this? For the mountains will I take up a weeping and wailing. For the habitations of the wilderness, pastures, the habitations where the sheep are, because they are burned up, none can pass through them. Neither can men hear the voice of cattle anymore in the fields. There's drought-stricken, sun-baked and burnt. Both the fowl of the heavens and the beast are fled. They're gone. So now he's showing what's happening to the real productive lands of Israel because of the freakish weather. I'll make Jerusalem heaps, a den of jackals. I'll make the cities of Judah desolate without an inhabitant. Who is the wise man that may understand this? Well, it's he to whom the mouth of the Eternal has spoken. That's the wise man that can understand it. He sees why God has to punish the Christian nations first. He may declare it, what the land perishes, burned up like a wilderness, none passes through. The Eternal said, because they've forsaken my law that I set before them. They haven't obeyed my voice or walked therein. Wouldn't you think if somebody would just open their Bible and go through Isaiah and Jeremiah like we've done, they'd recognize what's wrong with Christianity? You'd think they would. Over and over and over it says, they've forsaken my law. They've gone away from my statutes and judgments. They've substituted their own ways. You'd think anybody would see that. That anybody would recognize that. Verse 13, because they've forsaken my law that I've set before them, they haven't obeyed my voice, neither walked therein. They've walked after the stubbornness. Imagination is really the word stubbornness of their own heart, and after Balaam, which their fathers taught them. So see, always again, it comes back to this sun worship, paganism. Therefore, thus says the Eternal of Hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I'll feed them, this people, with wormwood. I'll give them water of gall to drink. I'll scatter them also among the nations, the heathen, whom neither they nor their fathers have known. I'll send a sword after them. You know, in Ezekiel 5, it says exactly that same thing. You might notice that. He says the third of them will go into the third prophecy there, where he says, take a sharp razor, a knife, a barber's razor, cut off all the hair on your head, and then weigh it in scales, and it'll be so precise, a third of it will be burnt with a fire in the middle of the city when the days of the siege are filled. Then you take another third and smite about it with a knife, And then the third that's left, they're scattered into the wind, and then a sword is drawn out after them. And then even of them, a few are taken and hidden out in a place of safety. A few in number are bound up under God's skirts of protection. And then finally another out of that final third are cast into the middle of the fire and burned in the fire on all the house of Israel. So same thing exactly in Jeremiah is repeated again in Ezekiel. So when Israel is scattered among the nations, God sends a sword even after that final third that's scattered among the nations. And a lot of them are consumed till there's only a tenth left. Thus says the Eternal of Hosts, consider you and call for the mourning women. Now, of course, they hired people at the time of the funeral to come in and help everybody really grieve over something that was dead. They literally did that over and over. That's why it says in Matthew 9:23, Christ put all the mourning women out, just took the parents in, and of course raised the dead. But can you imagine, in order to get yourself to grieve the way you ought to over some beloved one that's dead, you have to hire a lot of mourners to come in, and professional wailers. Can't imagine that, going to a funeral and having people just groan and wail and agonize and bawl, and all because you didn't have the right emotional upset because they're gone now, and to try to help you have a right feeling toward the dead. Well, God says there are going to be so many dead, you're going to have to even teach your daughters to be mourners. Notice what he says here. Call for the mourning women, that they may come, and send for cunning. Here again, the ones that are real, specially skilled in this mourning, that they may come. Let them make haste, take up a wailing for us, that our eyes may run down with tears, and our eyelids gush out with waters, because the voice of wailing is heard out of Zion. How are we spoiled? We're greatly confounded, because we've forsaken the land, because our dwellings have cast us out. Look what we're doing. Our dwellings, we've corrupted the land so badly that more and more people are having to cramp up in more and more of the bigger cities, and more of the land is forsaken, until finally the highways are going to become desolate. I always wondered about that prophecy. Does that mean gas is going to be so scarce, the highways are desolate? Does it mean people just can't live except in the major cities? Therefore, there's hardly any people scattered through the countryside? I'm watching. But God says, because we've forsaken the land, because our dwellings have cast us out. So our own environments are going to cast us out. A lot of people are leaving Los Angeles with the smog, and have been for years, and the tornadoes and hurricanes and volcanic ash. Well, just keep that scripture in mind. Our dwellings cast us out. Yet, hear the word of the Eternal, O you women, you professional mourners. Let your ear receive the word of his mouth. Teach your daughters wailing, everyone her neighbor to lamentation, because there aren't enough wailers, there aren't enough mourners, there's so much death. Death has come up into our windows, it's entered into our palaces to cut off the children from without and the young men from the streets. And here again, the word children means infants. So it's that horrible. Speak, thus says the Eternal, even the carcasses of men shall fall as dung on the open field, as the handful after the harvestman. None shall gather them. They're just left there in this coming holocaust. Thus says the Eternal, don't let the wise man glory in his wisdom. Don't let the mighty man glory in his might. Don't let the rich man glory in his riches. How about that for a threefold summary? See, God does that over and over and over. He uses that threefold summary. I'm surprised Trinitarians hadn't run across that and used that as a proof of the Trinity. They use terms like holy, holy, holy. That's proof of the Trinity, you know. If an angel flies through the sky and says, whoa, 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 that's another proof of the Trinity, you know. And that they miss the one that would be the most logical one. But look what is the problems of men. Wisdom, glory, riches. That's a pretty good summary, I'll tell you. But let him that glories, glory in that that he understands and knows me. That's what we all need to really think about that. We don't need to glory in wisdom. Men have gone out of the church doing that. We don't need to glory in might. Ambitious people have been wiped out through that. Some have gloried in riches. They wouldn't sign a new contract, you know, because they'd lose their severance. if you're not intending to ever leave the ministry, why would you ever need servants? Let him that glories glory in this, that he understands and knows God, that God is the eternal, that exercises loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness. There's another threefold summary. Look at that. Loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness. Now, is that all God exercises? No more than you only tithe corn, wine, and oil. In these things I delight, says the Eternal. Behold, the days come, says the Eternal. I'm going to punish all them that are circumcised with the uncircumcised. So everybody that's claimed they're Christian is going to get punished in the last trumpet plagues and the last days of punishment, all in unison, regardless of whether they're circumcised or uncircumcised. Egypt and Judah and Edom and all the children of Ammon and Moab, all that are in the utmost corners that dwell in the wilderness, all these nations are uncircumcised. Yeah, and all the house of Israel is uncircumcised in the heart. They just circumcised physically, but not really in their heart. So they're going to have to be punished with everybody else that's uncircumcised.
Okay, Jeremiah chapter 10, the chapter we all memorize is the Christmas tree chapter. Hear you the word which the Eternal speaks unto you, O house of Israel. So here again he's talking to the whole nation, all of the tribes. Thus says the Eternal, don't learn the way of the heathen. And of course, right away that takes you back to the law of God, as so many chapters do in prophecy. They're actually telling you what's happening to you because you didn't listen when the law said, do this or don't do that. So many of the verses in Isaiah and Jeremiah take you right back to Leviticus and Deuteronomy and Exodus and Genesis. And of course this one does as well, because God said way back in Leviticus 20, don't go and see how the nations serve their gods and then say, that looks like a good idea. Let's make a Christian celebration out of that. Let's serve our God with that Christmas tree and those Easter rabbits. And so again, God says, don't learn the way of the nations. And don't be dismayed at the signs of the heavens. As, of course, eclipses and meteorites and all kinds of zodiacs and everything else, heathen people don't see things greater than the heavenly bodies, so they worship them and they're afraid of their signs and they're planning their everyday life by the heavenly bodies, the signs of the heavens. Because that's the way the Gentiles are, the heathen. They're dismayed at these signs of the heavens. The customs, and here the Hebrew word's actually statutes, C-H-U-Q, the statutes of the people are empty. They're without any content. They're vain. So what are these customs? Well, they're talking about the religious practices, whether it's masses or Christmases or Easters or whatever they are. Those are the religious laws of these heathen worships. The customs, the statutes of these people are vain. And then he illustrates one of these statutes of the nations that are vain. And in the Hebrew, it makes it a little plainer here. It says, it's but a tree which one cuts out of the forest, the work of the hands of the workmen with the axe, but they deck it with silver and with gold. They fasten it with nails and with hammers that it move not. And then you have a poor translation in the King James here. The Jewish translation in verse 5 says, they're like a pillar in a garden of cucumbers. In other words, they're like scarecrows. That's what these customs of the heathens' ways of worships, they're like scarecrows in a garden of cucumbers. These trees can't speak. You have to even carry them about in the religious processions because they can't go of themselves. So how can they be gods? How can you worship in these ways? Don't be afraid of them. In other words, that doesn't mean don't worry about having a Christmas tree in your house in December. It can't hurt anything. That's the way some people read that. Well, that isn't what it says. Don't have this eerie fear and suspicious air about these heathen gods, and they're going to get you if you don't appease them. So bury one of your kids in the cornerstone of your house to keep the spirits away. Pass your children over the fire to keep fire out of your home. Don't be afraid of these customs of the heathen. Don't be that superstitious and fearful and worrisome. They can't really hurt you. But they can't do you any good either. How could you think a tree that you cut out of the forest and deal with in this manner, how can that do you any good? That you can't be superstitious about black cats or broomstick riders or anything else. They can't do evil. There's none like you, O Eternal. You're great. Your name is great in might. So now he contrasts the living God of great power with these helpless pagan worships that can't do any good at all. And gods that are trees, gods that are heavenly bodies, gods that are superstitions that can't do you any good. None of those are like you, O Eternal. You're great. Your name is great in might. Who wouldn't fear you, O King of Judah? Is that what that says, verse 7? You know, is God just a nationalistic God? Is God just a tribal God of the tribe of Judah? No, he's not. He's the King of Nations. But you know, a lot of people's arguments against the Sabbath, against tithing, against the holy days, they say, why, those are just nationalistic. Those are just for the nation of Israel. Those are just for the nation of Judah. But interestingly enough, when God gave the Ten Commandments, it was Elohim, the universal name for God. The same way happens again and again. Who wouldn't fear you, O King of Nations? So they have the Queen of Heaven, and we have the King of Heaven, and we have the King of Nations. That nobody fears that God until they know who he really is. For to you does it appertain, for as much as among all the wise of the nations and in all their kingdoms, there's none like you. So you can look into Hinduism and Buddhism and the Islam religion or whatever you want. And there just isn't any like God as a living being who is spirit, who has power and character. He's not like a tree, he's not like a river, he's not like an animal, he's not like a heavenly body. Among all the wise of the nations and all their kingdoms, there's none like the real true God. They're altogether brutish and foolish. The stock, the trunk of a tree, or the idol that's made from the tree stump, is a doctrine of vanities. Just appealing to your human nature. You know, the songs you sing in these religious ceremonies, they make you feel good. They don't change you. They don't praise God. You notice the difference in the songs of the Bible compared to the old Protestant hymns? And I don't know how many of you were down in Jekyll Island when one of the ministers gave a sermonette about the comparison between the songs that we sing and the ones in the world. And how the ones that we sing, the ones in the book of Psalms, are praises to God. They're hallowing God's name. They're calling to remembrance the works of old. They're reminding God of his promises. But what about the songs of the world's religions? You know, they sing, I come to the garden alone while the dew is still on the roses. I do this and I do that. You know, most of the Protestant songs, you're the subject of the song. You're literally making yourself feel better, although you're not changed a bit. You know, you ever wonder why it is? When you come back out of that old Baptist church, you feel so much better. Didn't change you a bit. You've got a formula, you know. If you go to church every Sunday, you're better. So you come out and you feel better. And you see other people on the streets that didn't go, and you feel better than they are. They didn't go. But it didn't change you a bit. And that's what he's getting across here. All these customs, the attitudes of the heathens, they're altogether brutish and foolish. The very stock of them is a doctrine of vanities. The silver spread into plates is brought from Tarshish. And that's one of the scriptures they use to indicate that this is talking about Spain. Because in the Tordesillas area of southern Spain, they're renowned for silver. You can find Ezekiel 27:12 talks about the same thing. So here he talks about, again, the way they beat out metals and put them over wood and stone. And why would you do that? To make it appear like it isn't wooden and stone, like it's something greater or more beyond that? Well, they bring gold from Some feel this is a different way of wording Ophir, which was always famous for gold. The work of the workmen, the hands of the founder, blue and purple is their clothing. So most of these gods, you know, to cover the wood and the stone, you put garments on them, as you see in the parades of the heathen practices, whether it's from China or Japan or whether it's from the Mardi Gras or wherever it is. So they put purple and blue on their clothing and deck them with silver plate and gold plated. They're all the work of cunning men. But the Eternal is the true God. He's the only God. He's the living God. He's an everlasting king. He doesn't die like an evergreen tree does. He doesn't fall apart like stone does, flake away like gold or silver plated. The Eternal is the true God, the living God, an everlasting king. At his wrath, the earth shall tremble. But you don't need to worry about the wrath of the fire god or the rain god or the goddess of fertility or all these heathen superstitions and practices. We should never be afraid of them. But ignorant, unconverted, blinded people are. But the Eternal's wrath is going to cause the earth to tremble, so they won't have to fear any eerie, superstitious mystery. But his very wrath will cause the earth to tremble. The nation shall not be able to abide his indignation. And there again is talking about the seven last plagues, the wrath of God. The trumpet plagues, the first four trumpets, are actually supernatural interventions by God on the earth to stop man from annihilating life. So with God's wrath, the earth's going to tremble and the nations aren't going to be able to abide. They're going to fall and be conquered and be changed over. Now all of a sudden, verse 11 is in a different language, in the Chaldean language. Whether that's because it's a note from Jeremiah to the king that was to warn his people about what was coming. You know, people that are sacred names people, they'd have you believe that certain languages are sacred. And to say God's name in any other language than Hebrew is wrong. So they go around saying Yahshua and Yahweh, and you know, the odd thing about that is, if you saw God's name, YHWH, the four-letter God, the holy name of God the Jews wouldn't even translate, how would you know how to pronounce that, you know, YHWH? Just kind of, something like that? How do you know what vowels to put in it, you know? You wouldn't know how to pronounce that. So they call him the Tetragrammaton, the four-letter God. And that name was so sacred they wouldn't even write it, so they substituted another name for it in the Bible. But you know, part of the Bible's written in Chaldean, part of the Bible's written in Aramaic, part of the Bible, the whole New Testament's written in Greek. What do? You just throw all that out, or you have to speak it in Hebrew? Well, a good bit of the book of Daniel's written in Chaldean. That's not a pure holy language. But people have some nutty doctrines. That's really a weird one. We've battled that one since way back in the 50s, though. People used to go around in that sacred names movement. Well, here's a whole verse written in Chaldean, apparently from Jeremiah to the king, telling him, you're responsible. You better wake up these people. The gods that haven't made the heavens and the earth, they shall perish from the earth and from under these heavens. But that letter or document to the king didn't do any good. He didn't listen. There again, the word gods is Elohim, so the name by itself doesn't necessarily mean holiness or sacredness. The gods that haven't made the heavens and the earth. You notice when it comes back to the true God, it always centers on creation, the proof of God. He has made the earth by his power. He has established the world by his wisdom. He has stretched out the heavens. There again is that threefold summary that God uses all the way through the Bible. A triune kind of a summary terminology. Made the earth, established the world, stretched out the heavens. And is that all he did? That doesn't talk anything about animals. Doesn't say a word about plants and man or anything else. But that's just a threefold summary. And yet some men in their wisdom go out saying, oh, you only tithe of corn, wine, and oil. Miners don't have to tithe, and fishermen don't have to tithe. And How ridiculous and dumb, you know. Let's all be fishermen and miners, and we don't have to tithe then. Well, God made the earth by his power, established the world by his wisdom. Of course, you remember Proverbs 8, where wisdom's personified as being there in the beginning when God did all that creating. So that proverb ties right in exactly with that scripture. The world by his wisdom he established. Everything's balanced. Everything's in its place. Everything survives jointly with each other and has stretched out the heavens by his discretion. When he utters his voice, there's a multitude of waters in the heavens. And he causes the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth. And you know, some scientists, I have a little book called the Jefferson Bible. Thomas Jefferson collected some things out of the Bible that were morals of Christ primarily. But he has some quotes in there, and they said, well, he was asking scientists, how did you arrive at the fact the earth was round? And it said, well, I saw in the Bible it says the circle of the earth. And he asked another scientist, well, how did you arrive at the circulation of the blood? And he said, well, it says that in the Bible. And they said, well, how did you ever arrive at this idea about the waters being evaporated and then going into the clouds and then gradually getting heavy in the clouds and then falling out of the clouds and going back to the oceans and back to vaporizing again? He said, oh, I read that in Jeremiah 10. So, you know, the Bible's a pretty good book to have around. It's got a lot more in it than you might think. So when God utters his voice, there's a multitude of waters in the heavens. And then all of a sudden, when the waters begin to be more and more of a multitude, they come down. And he causes the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth, and they go back up into the clouds until the clouds get too heavy, and back down they come again. But if you cut out all the timber and put mountains in there to block the rain, then what do you have? He makes lightnings with rain and brings forth the wind out of his treasuries. There are other scriptures you can tie in with that if you want. The lightnings with the rain, Psalm 135, verse 7 says the same thing. As far as bringing the wind out of his treasures, you know, where does the wind start? If you got a 35-mile-an-hour wind from the east, where do you go till you get out of it? As you go further east, is it less and less? And when you get to the edge of it, you know, where's the edge of darkness? Where does darkness begin? Well, those are all God's treasuries. We'll find out one of these days. But God has stretched out the heavens. Well, wait a minute. God makes... brings forth the wind out of his treasures. Job 38:22 says the same thing. Every man who's worshiping these idols is brutish in his knowledge. So just like those idols are brutish, those customs, all those religious practices, so are the men who follow them. All the men who follow these customs are brutish in their knowledge. Every founder who meddles up above and gods is confounded by the graven image. For his molten image is falsehood. There's no breath in them. They're not living beings. They're just wood and stone. They're vanity, empty, hollow, vacuums, the work of errors. In the time of their visitation, they'll all perish. When Christ comes back and the time's up, all these gods are going to perish. But not the portion of Jacob. God is the portion of Jacob. He's not like them. He's the former of all things. Israel is the lot of his inheritance. The eternal boast is his name. But he's contrasted again and again to these vain, empty, nonsensical idols. Gather up your wares out of the land, O inhabitant of the fortress. For this says the eternal, behold, I'll slay out the inhabitants of the land. At this once, and will distress them, that they may find it so. Woe is me for my hurt. My wound is grievous. But I said, truly, this is a grief, and I must bear it. My tabernacle is spoiled. All my cords are broken. My children are gone forth of me. And they're not. There's none to stretch forth my tent anymore to set up my curtains. So God's looking down on his punished countries, and they're desolate. For the pastors are become brutish. They've not sought the eternal. You know, when you realize, I forget what the percentage is now, of all the Protestant preachers don't even believe in the second coming of Christ. A lot of preachers don't even believe in the infallibility of Scripture. So, God says the pastors are become brutish, just like the dumb idols are brutish, and just like every man that follows these dumb idols is brutish. In other words, they're just going by their animal nature. They don't know God, they're not enlightened in their minds, they're just going by the physical. Therefore, they'll not prosper, all their flocks shall be scattered. So that's what's going to happen to all the different Christian churches in the future, as well as the others. Behold, the noise of the brute is come, and a great commotion out of the north country. So again and again and again, how many times we run across that? The power that's going to punish Israel is going to come out of the north country. And he's going to make the cities of Judah desolate, a den of jackals. He's also going to do that to Israel. Oh, eternal, I know that the way of man isn't in himself. So you can't just know within yourself what is the truth and who is God and why you're here. And, you know, you can't get it from psychologists or psychiatrists that just sit around and let their carnal brains run in gear. It isn't in a man, the way of man. It isn't in himself. It's not in man that walks to direct his steps. You have to have God reveal it to you. You have to have it from a higher authority. You can never just sit around and sit down and your nature ever figure it out. It'll never do it. It would never come to it. Oh, eternal, correct me, but with judgment. So right away, you know, when you pray and ask God for correction, you better be sure you add that in a hurry. In mercy or with judgment, not in your anger, lest you bring me to nothing. So you see, God is a living being who gets angry, who feels sadness. You know, God is a perfectly balanced personality. And to do that, you have to be able to get worked up and get emotional and yet be stable and sound and solid. Pour out your fury upon the heathen that know you not. I noticed several of the commentaries I read tried to apologize for poor old Jeremiah here, asking God to let him have it. Well, that's one proof of the Bible, you know, that they don't make their heroes infallible. And when you read about any man of God in the Bible, they're all human. They all make mistakes, and they all sinned, and they all had to battle with the nature just like the people that they led and worked with. Otherwise, how could they understand them? How could they have mercy for them? You know, that's why God had to have Christ come down, because he had to be tempted in every point like as we are, and it says that's why he can be touched with the feeling of our infirmities. You know, that's why God makes you go on living after you're converted, after you have God's Spirit. So later on you can say, hey, look, I know what that battle's like. Well, I had a battle with myself too. You know, I was a human back in the old world too, so don't expect me to zap you with every little mistake. And if husbands judge wives that way, you know, with what judgment you judge, you shall be judged. So you have to be careful. Pour out your fury upon the heathen that know you not, and upon the families that don't call on your name, because they've eaten up Jacob and devoured him and consumed him and made his habitation desolate. You notice number four, God revealing himself. Again and again you'll find it. So when God reveals himself in Jacob's punishment, look what they do. Eat up, devour, consume, make his habitation desolate. Four things specifically given and said. So you know God is revealing himself in that punishment or judgment on Israel. So those are three good verses of prayer. Mark them. I've got them green here. Correct me, but with judgment, not in your anger,